I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It seemed straightforward at the time. U.S. military leaders were so confident about their ability to dismantle Iraqi resistance that they printed up the enemy's faces on a deck of cards. 1 year later, some of those same military planners and leaders are admitting that they still don't really know who the bad guys are, or where they are, or how they managed to maintain such an effective guerrilla campaign against the U.S. in Iraq. 1 year after General John Abizade declared that the U.S. was fighting a classic guerrilla-type war in Iraq, there are now hard questions being asked about the U.S. ability to deal with such an enemy. Today we're talking about what lessons have been learned and what lessons have been missed by the military in Iraq. What do you think? Was it bad planning and bad leadership that made it so difficult for troops to do the job? Is it reasonable to say that the insurgents simply outflanked and outmaneuvered the U.S. Army? And so is there a better way to manage an insurgency? Or is there a better way to run an army? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting the program today in Washington with Mark Mazzetti. He's defense correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Mark was an embedded reporter in Iraq and has kept a close eye on the military response since then. He's joining us on the line from Washington. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for asking. At the time of this one-year anniversary of the insurgency, what kind of second-guessing or criticism are you really hearing in Washington?
Well, when Abizade said that the United States was involved in a guerrilla-type war a year ago, he was praised for being candid, because for 2 weeks or so, the Pentagon had basically denied that the U.S. was really involved in such a type of war. They said that these were just the remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld called them dead-enders. But Abizade said, no, this is something more serious. But now, a year later, the questions really are, you know, has the U.S. military ever gotten a handle of what it's up against in Iraq? There, as you alluded to before, they printed up this deck of cards with the top 55 members of Saddam Hussein's regime. Well, now a lot of those cards have been taken out of commission, and still the enemy is killing U.S. troops and Iraqi civilians at a near daily rate. So there's still a lot of war left, and the insurgency has gained steam in recent months.
So the leaders and the planners that you're in touch with in Washington, are they still disputing over whether or not anything was learned?
Well, I think they say that it. Much has been learned on the ground, but it's sort of a trial and error. And they say that different parts of Iraq require different strategies. You need a different strategy in the Kurdish north, in areas like Mosul, than you do in places like Basra, where it's predominantly Shia. At the same time, in the Sunni heartland, places like Fallujah and Tikrit, this is where the biggest problems have been experienced by the U.S. military, and the estimates of the insurgent strength have not really gone down over the last year. They're still talking about 5,000 or so insurgents, even after however many hundreds of them have supposedly been killed. So, again, I think there's admission in Washington that they don't have a really clear sense, again, of who's killing U.S. troops.
New Army Secretary talked about today in the newspaper, Francis Harvey may take on that job. Is that in any way, according to you, Mark, an indication that someone needs to say, all right, let's get our house in order from the top on down?
I think that's probably more of a result of other issues in the Army, and that's things like personnel. It's been widely reported that the Army is very stretched. They have about 130,000 troops in Iraq right now, and expect to have a large number well into the future. They're also tied down in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And this comes after a huge drawdown after the Cold War. So I think that the appointment of a new Army secretary is in large part to sort of, as you say, get their house in order, but it's on terms of things like, you know, does the Army have enough people to do all the missions that the White House is asking them to do.
All right, Mark, thanks for starting us off this hour.
Thank you.
Mark Mazzetti, defense correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I'd like to introduce my other guest for the hour. Owen Cote is here with me in our Boston studio. He's associate director of MIT's Security Studies Program and has been with us a number of times before. Welcome back, Owen. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
And retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor is joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. He's author of a new book called Transformation: Under Fire, Revolutionizing How America Fights. He's also a colonel at the Center for Technology and National Security at the National Defense University. Colonel McGregor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You say right at the very beginning of the book that war transforms armies. Is this war, or has this war, started the transformation of this army?
No, I don't think it has. In theory, war should do for armies what the market does for business and induce real fundamental change. I don't think that's occurring. In fact, I see the army in its modernization programs, even structurally, still clinging to the past as much as it possibly can and tinkering on the margins of what already exists. And this is not unusual.
What do you mean by clinging to the past? What do you say? What's something that I would see that you could point to me that I'd understand as an example of that?
Well, we went through a period all through the 1990s where we arrived at a series of assumptions about the future that I don't think were valid. One of those was based on the notion that somehow or another improved networking and the dissemination of information was going to provide everyone with a perfect picture of the enemy, of where he was and everyone with him happened to be, to the point where, quite frankly, armored protection was going to be of diminished importance. Accurate, devastating firepower in close combat would not be important. In fact, people talked and are still talking in the context of the Future Combat System, which is a multi-billion dollar program, of a future in which there is no close combat. Then if you look at the structural changes that are currently underway, the emphasis is increasingly on a very vulnerable light infantry constabulary force on wheels, a great diminishment once again of armor, continued reliance on this networking of information, which is not a bad thing, but is not going to produce the perfect outcome that is anticipated. So those things don't seem to be informed by the reality of combat on the ground. I don't see much evidence that the soldiers, sergeants, lieutenants, and captains, who now have infinitely more combat experience than the senior officers who command them, are having any impact at all on the composition, structure, and design of forces.
Owen Cote, is this a time when the Army really needs to look at the way that it's put together, the way that it's controlled and commanded?
It definitely is. I have a slightly different perspective than Doug does, in the sense that if you look at the wars that the Army was preparing for, and if you look at the war in Iraq, the first, you know, month or two of that war, you see a dramatic, historic, revolutionary success in traditional kinds of battles between armies in the field. So all of that stuff that Doug was referring to, in some sense, we've demonstrated that it works in a traditional kind of battle. So the question really becomes, what kind of battles do you expect as an army to be asked to fight? And the issue here in Iraq, which is overwhelming, you know, the big issue right now is the Army prepared to wage a counterinsurgency?
But can't you say, though, Owen, that really there wasn't the traditional battle in the first month or so, because, you know, once these guys were roaring up the highway from Kuwait to Baghdad, it was seen in a traditional perspective. But even back then, there were signs of what was to come, were there not, when soldiers who were supposed to stand and fight just didn't do that?
Sure, but some of them did, and those paid big time. And if you read the details, you know, if you read the books that have come out, and if you talk to people, you know, the embedded reporters, for example, and the actual soldiers, you know, there was a lot of close combat, right? And we were prepared for that kind of close combat for the most part. The issue really is, do we expect a future to involve a lot of situations in which our army is going to go into another country, take out the regime, and be responsible for it? And see, I would argue that the army gets a lot of mixed signals on this question from the political leadership. Mm-hmm. What did this administration run on as a ticket? No more nation building. No more going in and doing on any scale, you know, the argument there being no more Kosovos, basically. And here we are now with the largest sort of counterinsurgency campaign that we've had to deal with since Vietnam. So it's tough being the Army in that respect, because, you know, you're getting a lot of mixed signals from your political leadership.
Doug McGregor, what about those mixed signals? That didn't make it any easier for the Department of Defense or the people at the Pentagon, the generals.
Well, maybe. I think it's more complex than that. First of all, I don't agree with Owen's characterization of the campaign. There was nothing particularly historic about it. I'm surprised that it lasted as long as it did. We face probably the weakest enemy we've seen since the Spanish-American War. 90% of our battles, though, that we had on the ground, incidentally, were encounter battles. They were meeting engagements. So completely refuting this notion that somehow or another we were going to know what the enemy was up to. fact, the enemy was in complete chaos, and almost anything you would have undertaken against him would have worked. So I think that needs to be kept in mind. I wouldn't compare what happened there with other truly historic military campaigns. The second thing is there was an unwillingness at senior levels, and this is part of the reason that Secretary Rumsfeld struggled for as long as he did with the senior leaders of the Army, to come to terms with the reality that the enemy really was very weak and incapable, and that the focus needed really to be on what you would do once you got to Baghdad. There was an obsession with an enemy that never really existed. The enemy in 91 was weak and incompetent. He was much weaker and even more incompetent in 2003.
But are you saying that Rumsfeld and company should have known that?
Well, I'm not saying anything about Rumsfeld. I think Rumsfeld understood that the enemy was quite incompetent. I think that civilian leaders have a right to expect from their senior military leaders a degree of understanding and competence that I'm not sure he's gotten. Let me be perfectly frank. How difficult was it to discern the requirement for new rules of engagement as you advanced into the country and you discovered that most of the army for which you had prepared wasn't going to fight you at all, that in fact most of the army melted away and disappeared? How difficult was it to ensure that the soldiers who arrived in Baghdad would know exactly what you wanted them to do when they got there? We certainly did during the Second World War when we arrived in places like Paris or Aachen and ultimately in Berlin and elsewhere. We knew what buildings we wanted to go to. We knew what people we were looking for. And we had teams set up for that precise purpose. Those kinds of things were not done. So we kind of arrived at Baghdad expecting a big fight that Rumsfeld, to his credit, never believed in. But the Army generals insisted would happen. It didn't happen. And then suddenly, we did nothing. For 30 days, there was chaos. We stood around. We didn't protect specific ministries. The only one that was protected initially was the oil ministry. Our soldiers were not ordered into the streets to restore order. And when people questioned them, journalists on the ground, and said, well, why can't you put a couple of tanks and a couple of Bradleys over here and protect this area or the street corner or something? The answer was, well, we don't have enough troops. Well, again, what was the planning that went into this militarily? I mean, the ground component commander is responsible not just for the campaign that takes you to Baghdad. He's also responsible for what happens after you arrive. No thinking went into this, as far as I can tell, and there was no strategy, coherent strategy, as to what we wanted to do once we got there. After about 30 days, we settled into division sectors. And I asked at the time, why are we going into these division sectors, spreading 23,000 troops out over a mini province and turning a division commander into a governor general? And the answer that was given to me was, well, we did that in Vietnam, and no one seemed to know what else to do. That's not very encouraging. Laying that blame entirely on the civilian leadership would be analogous to blaming Franklin Roosevelt for why we didn't do something once we arrived in Aachen or Berlin.
I need to stop you right there for a moment, Colonel. We're going to take a short break, but I want to take part of what you're saying and part of what Owen Cote has been saying and ask our listeners to join us on how we are to regard the way the Army dealt with the insurgency, the moment that Colonel McGregor was just bringing us to. Was it bad planning? Was it bad leadership? Did the insurgents, in fact, outmaneuver and outflank the U.S. Army? 1-800-423-8255 to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The number to join our conversation this hour, 1-800-423-TALK. Was there a better way to manage the insurgency in Iraq, which still goes on? Is there a better way to run the U.S. Army to do that, or should the Army not even have been involved? 1-800-423-8255. Douglas McGregor is with us. He's a colonel with the Center for Technology and National Security at the National Defense University. And here with me in the Boston studio, Owen Cote, Associate Director of MIT's Security Studies Program and co-editor of International Security. Owen, let me start with you. Thoughtful planners might have been able to see the insurgency coming. In fact, you've said that given what the stated aims of the United States were, and those were fairly well known, everybody should have been able to see some kind of resistance coming to this.
Right. If your plan clearly stated is to have a unified, reasonably democratic, secular state in Iraq after the departure of Saddam Hussein, there's literally no way that you can see all three major groups within Iraq agreeing about the way forward. And, you know, some of the details are obvious. You're going to one man, one vote is going to take away all the power that the Sunnis had under Saddam Hussein.
So they'll fight it on that level.
They're going to fight it on that level. A secular society, the Shiites, the largest group in Iraq, are going to have problems with that. A unified country. Well, various definitions of unification are going to cause problems for the Kurds. So what we've seen for the most part in the last year is the Sunni problem, right? Well, the Shiite Kurd issues, they're still out there lingering. So from a structural point of view, you could see that there was a high probability there's going to be some level of insurgent resistance to this operation. And I think that if you're an army planner, it's true to say that the army's conservative instincts about the initial battle were that they needed much more force than they really needed to defeat this army. And the pressure was put on them to reduce the size of the force. And if you read Woodward's book, you can see the size of the force going in notches down over the months of planning and gets to what is a relatively small level. So that if you look at that war, then you come up with that outcome. Then you look at the history of counterinsurgencies and you say, you know, there's a broad sort of rule of thumb. How many soldiers do you need to sort of establish a monopoly of violence in a country, which is
what do you mean a monopoly of violence?
The essence of a state, you know, according to Max Weber, is one of the essences of a state is the holding the monopoly on violence to provide security. Well, in a society where there's a lot of resistance to you being the holder of that monopoly, history's shown that you need, you know, something like one soldier for every 20 people in the society that you're managing. And we're at, you know, a level of two orders of magnitude worse than that, lighter than that. So that's another war that you have to potentially plan to that might produce a very different force, a larger force initially, at least initially. And the force that we took in to Iraq was the force for the first part of the battle. And so, and Doug's right. The army resisted that. Now, why they resisted it? Did they resist it because they're hidebound conservatives and they like to go places, you know, in units of 500,000 at a time? Or did they, some of them have a sense that, well, okay, as Colin Powell has said, you know, we're about to break this country. That means we're going to own it. Should we think about, and as far as who's responsible for the failure, which I think is clear in terms of post-war planning, I don't know who to assign that to. The army commander in Iraq, you know, the people in the Secretary of Defense that are responsible for the political military aspects of the war. I'm sort of secular about that, but a failure definitely occurred.
Okay, you're leading me to one of the principal points in Douglas McGregor's new book, Transformation Under Fire, and that I guess we see that in a news story from earlier this week, Colonel, when we know that the Iraqi interim government has slightly greater control over security decisions. Now, I say only slightly. And a few days ago, when it was thought that they'd figured out a safe house of some of the insurgents in Fallujah, they dropped 3 tons of bombs on that one house. Some 10 people were killed. But I was thinking about that and thinking, there's the shift back to those parts of the military that everybody knows works, the Air Force, their ability to drop bombs, and you point to the Navy as well, but never, and stop me if I'm wrong, but never are they relying as they should on the people on the ground.
Well, right now, the emphasis is on essentially distancing our forces on the ground from danger. There's an obvious political interest in reducing casualties, keeping them to a minimum. We are, after all, in an election year. So our soldiers are not as visible as they were. We turned this thing over to this new Iraqi government early, ostensibly for the purpose of helping to justify a certain pullback, if you will. I'm not sure what that government is. I'm uncomfortable because I don't know how much of a government exists below the people we listen to in Baghdad. It's hard to fathom that sort of thing. I agree with Owen that there has very definitely been a failure. When we went into the country, there were three things that were critical right off the bat, and all of the people that had worked with us who were Arabs told us this, said number one is security, obviously, number two, jobs, and number three, power generation. And unfortunately, we have failed on all three counts. And one of the problems we had as the insurgency grew was our insistence on essentially throwing all of the soldiers who had formerly been in the Iraqi army, who had done as we asked, by the way, and had largely not fought us at all, and threw them out of work. Suddenly you had thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of men who had weapons, who went home with the weapons that they had, and they had nothing to do. We then sent our soldiers, who speak no Arabic, who know nothing about tribal society, nothing about Arab society, nothing about Islam and the social norms of that particular part of the world, and made them police the area. And this was nothing short of a disaster. I mean, the American soldier is going to do whatever he's asked, and I still think our soldiers are the best that we've probably ever had. In fact, I think they are the best that we've ever had right now.
But they can't do the impossible. We end up with at the place where the insurgents, to their credit, were able to adapt to changing circumstances. And the U.S. Army was not able to adapt.
Well, I think we fed the insurgency. We stimulated it. Our soldiers, who can't speak Arabic and are operating in very difficult circumstances, are then sent on these heavy-handed raids into people's homes, arresting arbitrarily every man of military age. We ended up incarcerating, the latest number I've seen, is about 46,000 people. And we admitted that fewer than 10% of the people that we incarcerated ultimately had any business ever being locked up. And in that part of the world, when you maim, when you injure, you accidentally kill someone somewhere, or you incarcerate them and then essentially tell their families nothing for long periods of time, you make thousands and thousands of enemies. And we did. So we stimulated what was really a very modest beginning to the insurgency. We fed it. We made it worse. We accidentally recruited for it in much the same way, I would argue, as the British in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, through some of the same measures, inadvertently recruited for the IRA when they locked up large numbers of Irish Catholics without trial, incarcerated them for long periods, and did not treat people carefully and thoughtfully. And this is something that is not necessarily the fault of the soldiers on the ground.
Right.
They did what they were asked to do. They did the best they could. And
I just want to hear from Owen here. So was it the inability of their commanders to adapt
Doug made the point earlier, and I think this is really the decisive point, which is this moment that occurs after the formal fighting ends, where this utter vacuum exists, and you have this rampant looting across the country. I mean, buildings stripped clean. There's not an ounce of copper left, you know. And you see in this period of about a month or two where there's literally a total vacuum of power in vast parts of the country, including Baghdad. And I think the insurgency, as Doug pointed out, didn't start out big. But what happened was that there was a period of time where there was this kind of chaos, which you just don't ever want to allow under any circumstances.
If it's done with sort of smiles on the faces.
Right. I mean, this is never a good thing in a society, right? And at that point, I think we lost an opportunity to kind of fix the sort of big middle of the country, the sort of, what you call it, the silent majority or whatever, to sort of fix them in place in terms of seeing the outcome of the war as being something reasonably positive. And so I think at that point, after a couple of months into this, you know, the people that were going to fight us no matter what were operating sort of from fertile ground.
All right. I want to get to some of our callers. We're taking our first call from Iowa City, Iowa, and James is on the line. Hello, James.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Let me preface my comments by saying that I was in Vietnam. I was part of an elite group within Vietnam that handled counterinsurgency and that sort of thing. The situation in Iraq is typical of a lot of things we had in Vietnam. If you do not have decisive leadership from the top down, you are not going to have decisive actions taken in the field.
You mean military or civilian leadership?
I mean, starting with civilian leadership. The civilian leadership, the commander-in-chief is just that. If he says, this is what I want you to do, then it behooves the rest of the military to do that. But he says, well, gee, I don't know. What do you think? Then you run into a problem because it puts the military people in kind of a quandary. Well, what do you want us to do? Well, I don't know. What do you think?
So in context of where we are on this conversation, James, is it that the leaders for much of the past year have been reacting to events on the ground rather than making decisions in advance of those events happening?
Exactly. Exactly. What the problem seems to be is they didn't have a plan. The civilian leaders did not have a plan to say, okay, we're going to go into Iraq. We're going to take the country. We're going to protect these. They didn't do their homework, for starters. They didn't say, okay, we need to protect these buildings, this resource, so on and so forth. We're going to take this unit, and we're going to drop them here, and we're going to put this here and do that. They just said, well, let's see. We'll go north and see what happens. You know, it's bad planning from the word go. And as far as Donald Rumsfeld is concerned, you say, you know, Rumsfeld was blameless. It was the military leaders. Well, if Rumsfeld gave them specific instructions and they didn't follow them, then it's the military leaders' fault. But I don't think they had that sort of leadership from the civilian leaders.
All right, Douglas McGregor, are you agreeing with what James saying?
I think that's partially accurate. I think that there was some direction given, but I think the direction from the strategic level is always strategic. I don't see any evidence that President Roosevelt gave detailed instructions to Eisenhower on everything that was to happen from the time we crossed the Rhine River into Germany. But there was a great deal of study done by the United States Army long before we entered Germany concerning where we wanted to go and what we wanted to accomplish as soon as we crossed the Rhine. I think, once again, that was missing because of this inordinate focus on what was really a very weak and incompetent enemy. The other aspect of this thing that I think is very important is to understand that you're dealing with an Islamic country. This is different from other places. Now, we've been operating over in that part of the world for 12 years. But surprisingly enough, we've done very, very little to prepare ourselves to operate in that particular environment. The intrusive measures that we began to apply, checkpoints, raids, inspections, and so forth, on the assumption that this was somehow or another going to minimize terror, that this was going to improve our situation strategically, was really at odds with our own experience in Latin America, where we'd conducted some very successful counterinsurgency programs, and we learned that the most successful approach is one in which increasingly the American soldier fades into the background while supporting people who are there to execute the missions that are critical to success. That's something that we didn't seem to understand this time. We were very much in evidence. We took over. We blundered in many cases. We did some very good things. You know, for instance, someone talked to me the other day about, well, we rapidly refurbished schoolhouses and repainted school buildings. Well, that's true, but at the same time, we didn't fill hospitals with medicines and equipment. There was a certain unbalanced approach that was almost ad hoc, haphazard, if you will. We can recover from some of this, but there was one other aspect, and your caller's talking
about
decisiveness.
Hang on a second. I want to let Owen in here for half a second. Owen, what were you going to say?
I'm just curious about what Doug would think or about what James would think about this. You know, the thing that's striking to me is just a couple of months ago, we sent over, I think it's Major General or Lieutenant General, Doug can correct me, Petraeus, who was the former head of the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault Division, to begin the process of training an Iraqi army. Well, I mean, here's, to me, one of the biggest question marks in the whole operation. Why was not someone of his rank or even higher assigned that task 2 months before the war started? I mean, why, as Doug points out, in counterinsurgencies, it's very important that if there's foreign assistant for the counterinsurgents, that they be in the background. The people on the point have to be people from that society if you want to have some sort of success. We don't get around to deciding that we're going to train and rebuild an Iraqi army until a couple of months ago. And that seems to me to be just an unbelievable oversight.
All right. Number of people trying to get in with us. So next to Amherst, New York, John's with us. Hi, John.
Hi, Dick. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that it's very funny. Your guests are, I have to laugh once again. What he is saying is sort of contradicting himself. This is a brand new type of war. It's been stated that continually. And he comes from a place where that you actually teach military strategy based upon things that have already happened. Dealing with the terrorists and understanding that we have now 130,000 to 140,000 targets. Every U.S. military serviceman, anyone who has any connection with the United States or any coalition has a target on their back. And to start to talk about the thousands and thousands and thousands of terrorists and all these insurgents that are going after all these people, it just kind of belies, if we have that many targets, we're losing very few men.
John, what should have been done different, though, John?
Oh, my goodness. Listen, Dick, we learn as we go in this. And, you know, I hate to make that as any kind of an excuse. But unfortunately, I have to point out continually to people such as your guests, that this insurgency, the real vile heinous ones are being held, are being conducted by a Jordanian. He's not an Iraqi. And if anyone is more suited to deal with terrorists, it is our men in uniform. And you know what? When they take that oath, they vow to die in the defense of this country if the commander-in-chief says so. And I am not saying this has been perfect, but I want to know in what world you have a perfect outcome, especially these guys who are allegedly experts in the military.
I would agree with John 1,000%. I'm not sure if he's hearing some of us wrong. My view about a counterinsurgency is that anyone that tells you that there's some, you know, clean way to do a counterinsurgency, you should throw that advisor out of the room and never consult him or her again, right? This is the nature of this kind of battle. And the nature of the battle is might be nature's way of saying you should really think hard before embracing one. And that gets into the whole question about Iraq and the link to the war on terror and so on and so forth. We can leave that aside for now. But it by no means, shape, or form should anyone believe that it's possible ever to have a counterinsurgency campaign, be clean like the campaign that took only a month.
So the raids and the checkpoints and the kicking down of doors, that at one point had to be done. The point that we're arguing is, did we need to reach that level?
Well, I think that has to be done. But what you want is for the indigenous forces to be the ones that are really taking the lead when that has to occur. And, there are debates about how often you do that. There was an emerging debate that we were going to get to experiment with between the Army and the Marines, that the situation in Fallujah rendered moot because the Marines weren't allowed to do it. But they were going to kind of do this kinder, gentler approach. The British always say that they take a more kinder, gentler approach. Well, they're in Basra in the south, and that's never been the center of the insurgency. So that's an issue. But counterinsurgency itself is never going to be clean.
1-800-423-8255, the number to join our conversation this hour. And just this week, we see that the interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, has announced his intention to use a much tougher form of enforcement, martial law, if that's what is required to bring the insurgents to heel. Is that something that should have happened a long time ago? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. You might remember that moment in mid-July of last year when U.S. General John Abizaid stood on the podium just a week or so after he was given his commander's role and said, what the U.S. is dealing with is a classic guerrilla-type war. It certainly has been that since then, and many people are arguing about whether or not the Army is well-suited to deal with that kind of fight, whether or not it has learned any lessons, if these are the fights of the future. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Chesapeake, Virginia, and David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon. Listen, I got a couple things to say here. First off, we had relied on Chalabi's assurances that we would walk into Baghdad with palm fronds and huzzas, and what we got were RPGs and AK-47s. Number two, you can't know much about a culture. You can't know much at all about a culture unless you speak the language. We don't speak the language, but there are things that suffice for that. Sandra McKay wrote a book a number of years ago called The Saudis. I doubt that anybody in the government's read that. I see no signs of it. Now, the thing about it is, and also, number three, Mao Tse-tung and Che Guevara have both written out how to start a guerrilla warfare, and you poke the guy in the eye, you poke the big guy in the eye, and poke him in the eye until he does something egregious and big and makes the whole country angry. Now we have fallen down on all those points. We gave them gratuitously violence. Now, at what point are we going to say, what do these people actually want? Now we don't know. We've been told by the president that they hate us because we love freedom. All right, that's not good enough. That's not the reason. They don't hate us because we're Christians or whatever we are. We need to sit down with these people and say, okay, what is your side, and here's our side. This thing of following the neocon idea that we can walk in with $1 trillion worth of weapons and subdue these people, obviously it's not working. It didn't work in Vietnam. It's not going to work here or anyplace else.
David, let me just take you through the checklist that you've gone through. You're talking about poor intelligence. You're talking about a lack of sort of cultural intelligence and that lessons of of historic guerrilla insurgencies didn't seem to be learned. Are you putting the blame for that at the feet of the generals who should have been able to tell their soldiers how to act differently in the field? Where's that to be corrected?
Okay, we shot from the hip. I think we shot from the hip. I think that is a Department of Defense thing. It's training of the military is a Department of Defense idea. We have trained our soldiers and our sailors to do their craft, to actually go out and kill people. But at what point have we learned this to try to understand the people on the side? What do they want? What are we going to get out of this? And what are they going to get out of it? Because at this point, we're going to have to make some accommodations.
All right. Transformation under fire, Colonel McGregor. Is training the place to start? Is David right?
Well, it's not just training. It's also education. And it's the way you select people to command, how you identify people, and what you encourage them to do. We really haven't focused on anything other than preparing ourselves for something on the scale of what we think is another version of World War II. We're organized for that. We think in those terms. And even though we've had plenty of evidence since 1991 that we were going to have to face very dramatically different alternatives, whether it was Somalia or Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, doesn't seem to have made very much difference. And as a result, I think we arrived with senior officers that only knew one way to do things, and as a result, we have made some serious mistakes. Now, on the other hand, there is something that your previous caller mentioned that I didn't get a chance to address, and that's the criticality of when you do identify serious pockets of resistance, and those manifested themselves during 2003 in the summer and the fall, you should allocate decisive power to expunge those pockets. We never did. There was no reorganization or reorientation of the force on the ground. If you go back and listen to the various news conferences, the generals will tell you repeatedly, and accurately, by the way, that much of the country was, in fact, quiet. And it was during 2003. There were vast areas of the country that were quiet. But there was no attempt to pull forces from areas where they, quite frankly, weren't needed and to put them into areas where they were required. So
okay,
places
I'm a
like Fallujah and Aramadi and so forth.
Bingo. And that's where I'm confused, because you also made the point that the number of casualties is an indication of just how bad the insurgency has been managed. But if you put more forces into Fallujah and Ramadi, wouldn't there be a possibility that casualty count could be even higher?
Well, there's a vast difference between simply putting someone out there on static guard or on a patrol,
right,
and essentially bringing in combat power and making the decision to go into the area of Fallujah where you know your enemy has concentrated and destroy him. There's a very, very great difference, and there's a difference in terms of the mix of force that you use. If you look carefully at when we have actually gone after pockets of resistance and we've gone in there with armor, mm-hmm, we've lost one or two people. On the other hand, if you look at Fallujah, where the Marines sent in large numbers of light infantrymen to fight people through six or seven city blocks, several hundred casualties resulted, and over 100 people were killed.
Which brings us back, Owen, I think, to where you were in terms of, can the military do this? Is it a police action? Is it a military action?
Doug's making a good point, which is that for some reason, I don't understand it, civilian leaders seem to think that if it's a counterinsurgency, that means you send light forces in. If it's a traditional battle, you send heavy forces in. I think what's interesting, instructive here on several points, is look at the Israeli army, okay? The Israeli army's had a lot of experience with this. They have experience with it in Lebanon. They're having a big-time experience with it right now in the West Bank and Gaza. What does the Israeli army that operates in those areas look like? It's heavier than the forces that certainly most of the time in Iraq were driving around in Humvees, right, the Jeeps. The Israelis have come up with these special armored personnel carriers that are based on tanks. They have had bitter experience that if you want people to stay in a vehicle where there are RPGs around, it has to be heavy. Okay, so that's point one. But point two is, yes, the Army has a responsibility to train its soldiers. The Army has a responsibility to prepare them for all the kinds of battles they may face. I keep coming back to the point, if you look at the Israeli experience in both the areas I described, they do a lot of the things that Doug is talking about. They do a lot of the things that some of our callers are talking about. The insurgency goes on. Okay, there's a way in which that insurgencies can have this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, or this kind of, you know, endless cycle of you kill people and you create new insurgents. Secretary Rumsfeld himself several times has publicly indicated that he's asking that question of both himself and of his military leaders. They've never provided an answer. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, fighting an insurgency is something that you definitely want to avoid, you know, unless you're really, really driven to it, have no choice.
But I think, Doug, this brings us to a point that you make in drawing our attention to the U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan, the idea of infiltrating and getting people who are locals to work with you.
Well, absolutely, and we know how to do that, and we've done it very successfully for many decades. And it's unfortunate that we haven't paid more attention to it, and it's unfortunate that the conventional force has not looked at this more carefully. But keep in mind that Afghanistan, of course, is in a very different situation from Iraq. I would argue that there were very few people who were our enemies once we entered Iraq initially. And having talked recently to a number of Arabs from Iraq who are here in Washington at government expense to be trained in various things, they made it very clear that most of the population is actually quite grateful that we came and removed the regime. What the population is unhappy with is their perception of us as being indecisive and vacillating. They don't understand why there has been no adjustment in the way we behave on the ground. They couldn't understand why we felt the need to go through people's houses in great numbers. They couldn't understand a number of these things and pointed to these mistakes. At the same time, they couldn't understand why we simply backed away from Fallujah in April. Why would you allow Fallujah to become a symbol of resistance, a bastion of opposition, and now an operating base for terrorism inside Iraq? It's a very strange phenomenon.
We're going next to Louisville, Kentucky, and Alexis is joining us from there. Hi, Alexis.
Yes, hello. I wanted to comment on what was said just a moment ago. Exactly. The Iraqis, I'm pretty sure, are surprised how soft Americans are on insurgents, that they do not execute them, do not finish up Fallujah Rebellion, etc. And that makes me think that the U.S. as a democratic country, occupying undemocratic, brutalized country of Iraq, just didn't have a chance to suppress this rebellion. And that's what the new government is saying. They will execute those insurgents, and that only will allow this insurgency to be defeated.
But I mean, part of the problem that the army was up against, Alexis, is that there are a lot of people in this country who'd be pretty uncomfortable with the heavy hand approach to the insurgency, despite
exactly the case. So those people are to be blamed that American soldiers had to take those heavy casualties because
right.
of critics here and because of the world, so-called world opinion,
yeah.
making U.S. trying to defeat the rebellion in white gloves. No chance. So all those other items are secondary that your guests are talking about. The key is democratic country cannot defeat the brutalized regime or a brutalized country without using most brutal methods.
I want to, if I can, come back to the point of transformation that we started the program with. And Owen, I'll ask you on this. Do you think that this conversation, these conversations, are going to lead to, finally, sort of shift away from the Cold War 10 division mentality that Doug McGregor says really has to end?
If you look at how transformations have occurred in the past, you often see people who, sometimes within the military, who sort of lead the charge towards a new approach to a problem and trying to make the argument there are going to be new kinds of wars, new ways of fighting. And I think, Doug definitely has been one of those people within the Army. And I think that when you're in that kind of situation, you lay down a marker. You're normally going to be disappointed as to how the sort of beast that you're trying to influence responds. But me looking at from another perspective, the beast is responding. He's not responding maybe quite as fast as everybody wants. But, for example, the current Army Chief of Staff, the one recently appointed by Secretary Rumsfeld, General Schumacher, who incidentally has a Special Forces background, is engaging in some of the structural changes that people have talked about that the Army needs to pursue, making the units smaller, more modular, preparing for conflicts, as Doug pointed out, that aren't on the scale of the Central Front in Germany during the Cold War, that are more the kind of conflicts that we've seen. But I still come back to the idea of basic strategic question that we have to answer as a country is, do we really perceive that the future is going to be filled with more wars like the one in Iraq, where we actually go in, invade sovereign countries because of things that their leadership is doing or that we think they're doing, and then therefore become responsible for them. We really have to have that debate. Right now, we're in the middle of one. It's hard to have that debate. I would hope the campaign would lead to a debate like that.
But just to have that debate, to have that kind of adaptive thinking on the table, Doug, you teach at the National Defense University. There are a lot of people who've been in a lot of older wars there. We've, as you said this earlier in the program, we now have a generation of young officers who've been tested in specifically the kind of controversial battlefield that we're talking about. That alone's got to lead to some kind of rethinking and change, no?
Well, first of all, I don't teach at the National Defense University. I left the Army on the 1st of June, and I'm now an independent defense analyst.
Okay.
So please don't keep identifying me with NDU any longer.
Thanks.
Your second point is a very important one. There are a lot of very frustrated younger officers right now who are coming back with what I would argue is a very good understanding of how to do business in this environment, who have learned through trial and error. They are not being listened to. All decisions are being made at the top, and they are being forced down the chain. What the new chief of staff is doing structurally is not good. He is creating very incapable small units. When the people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan will tell you that you need a very high density of combat power on the ground where you are operating, we're ending up with smaller battalions. Our battalions today are already too small. The force design that I advocated is actually much more robust than what this chief of staff is putting together. And again, you're still ending up with divisions, but you're chopping them up into smaller pieces and making them, I would argue, less capable. That's passing for structural change. I think it's a bad idea. I don't think Owen has looked at it carefully enough. But the key piece of this is the soldiers, sergeants, lieutenants, and captains who have the critical combat experience, who have learned a great deal, who are not being listened to, who are not really profoundly shaping the transformation at the lowest level, where it is probably most important.
We have to leave this. I'm afraid we're out of time. Colonel McGregor, I want to thank you for being with us on the program. Douglas McGregor, retired colonel and author of Transformation Under Fire, Revolutionizing How America Fights. Owen Cote, it's good to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Owen is associate director of MIT's Security Studies Program. Earlier in the program, we talked with Mark Mazzetti. He's defense correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.